I'm Sarah Williamson, and this is Going Long with FCLT Global. On this show, you'll learn what it means to be long-term from the top minds in global business and investing. Leaders from companies and investment organizations join us to discuss how they are leading their teams for the long run on issues including capital allocation, risk management, climate change, and sustainability. To learn more, visit our website at fcltglobal.org. Welcome to this episode of FCLT Global's Going Long podcast. Today, I'm joined by James Anderson. James is a partner at Bailey Gifford, an investment management firm based in Edinburgh and a member of FCLT Global. He's joint manager of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and co-founded Bailey Gifford's long-term global growth strategy in 2003. James is also the panel chair of the Panmure House Prize, an award for research into long-term investing in innovation. So James, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, sir.
So we think of Bailey Gifford as the quintessential long-term investor. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what makes a good long-term investor? How have you been able to be a long-term investor? And you know, what are the kind of pitfalls? What's hard about being a long-term investor?
Well, in some ways, we thought it ought to be comparatively easy, Sarah, because we are, as you'll know, an independent traditional partnership, which should lay the foundations for thinking long term and not avoiding many of the pressures. But about 15 years ago, we decided that wasn't really happening. We, like everybody else, was getting tugged into the mentality of quarterly earnings and judging ourselves, which is much worse, by that criterion. And at the same time, we were, as you'll remember, we were entering the heyday of being told that everything was quicker, particularly financial markets and particularly hedge funds were quicker. And really that led to a lot of reflection on our and my part that we should live up to the values of being truly long-term that the partnership ought to give us. And that instead of hurrying up, we should slow down. And, you know, frankly, I've been amazed at how much has flown from that. You know, if we were to bring it right up to date, as we may get on to, many of the issues that I think have come to our minds now, much more to the forefront of our minds, are much broader than simply being better at investing. But I will try and answer your question about the pitfalls of this. And I think the pitfalls are absolutely as described by the late, great Hans Rosling in his book, Factfulness. And he used to come and talk to us at client conference. And indeed, one chapter on Factfulness is based on a Bailey Gifford meeting, though he doesn't say this. And it's all that extraordinary pressure of the events of the moment, our brains being hardwired to judge those, and the intense and odd appeal of negativity, both to investors and, you know, this huge pressure to avoid the downside, whether it be to your clients or just simply talking to your colleagues. And I think thereby what you need is a willingness to both be resilient, but I think still more, one of the oddly important parts is to not think very highly of yourself, because if you get sucked into that pattern of trying to judge everything, trying to have an opinion on everything and every stock at every moment, then I think it's very hard to be a long-term investor. So I think, you know, what one needs to do is keep reminding ourselves, myself in particular, how fragile it is and how much we can have not just a better chance of being right, but also I think a lot of this is about the quality of the information you thereby get by taking yourself out of what I was just describing there. Because as you well know, the probability of being right for an investor most times is somewhere around 52% if they're any good. In fact, if you look at underlying long-term trends, you can have a much greater certainty. And we can, or if you don't want to, we won't, do various examples of that. But I think you are actually meaning you're concentrating on much more important information and information that's much more likely to both be right and to give you an edge over the market. So it's one of these topics that, as you probably gathered, go on for years. But, you know, it's intriguing how much from those initial days of thinking about it, it's opened up.
That's, I think, many very important lessons there. I think the one about not thinking too highly of yourself, or maybe some humility, not treating the, I mean, as we know, you're right, in the short term, 52% is a good investor. That means you're going to be wrong an awful lot. You know, you have to have the sort of temperament to take that, that not everybody does. That is extremely important. And how do you think about the support of your clients or colleagues or others? Because inevitably, on the way to being right, sometimes it feels an awful lot like you're wrong. Or so are there things that you've learned over time to help insulate yourself or push back a little bit when you get that short-term pressure from others? How do you have that thick skin?
I think that's an absolutely fascinating and really important question. And, you know, I wouldn't want to conceal that I think, you know, luck does have a big part in this, because getting a good start really matters. You know, I remember very early times of trying to manage money on this much more consciously long-term basis. We had a few months, but it was just a few months of doing badly. And, you know, I think that would have ramped up the pressure an awful lot. So, you know, the luck ingredient does factor in, and, you know, becomes easier once it's worked a few times, as you know. But I would really stress the client part of this. You know, if I had to pick one really defining moment for me, for us, it was that we'd been appointed for Vanguard to be one of the managers in the International Growth Fund. And we went to see them after close to a year of managing money for the first time. And as you'll know, they do, all the senior people of the firm were sitting around a table, and we were feeling slightly intimidated anyhow. And the then CEO paused and said in a very loud but mellifluous voice, "We've got something very important to discuss." And I looked at my colleague, who looked at me, and we thought, this isn't going to be good. And he then paused for effect and said, "We're very pleased with you, because what you've done is entirely in line with the philosophy you told us you were going to invest by. And the fact that over the first 12 months, it hasn't produced the results that either you or I would like is immaterial compared to that." And I think from a major client who is supposedly not knowledgeable about active investment rather than passive ones, that was a huge moment. And I think having the security of some clients, and the same would absolutely apply to the board of Scottish Mortgage, that was really important. And I think that client part has actually been hugely important, because actually turning it back to the internal parts of that, that's what you gave you the confidence and security to proselytize about your colleagues about this. And I think that, you know, convincing everybody that there was a point to this, even if everybody was going to have slightly different nuances, was really important. But, you know, the best clients above all are just so hugely important. And I suppose, I think ultimately get the clients you deserve.
I think that's right. You do get the clients you deserve. And and I think that partnership between a good client and a good manager can really lead to a very different outcome over years and decades than what too many clients do, which is sort of, you know, buy high, sell low.
Yes. And that applies, I think, if I may interrupt you, sir, to individual stock decisions of importance as well, doesn't it? You know, those long, hard years of when Tesla's share price it wasn't really necessarily going down, but it was being volatile around a trend, but certainly not going up. And every single client basically wanted to ask you about that. And the ones that you were sort of being supportive of, it, you know, you remember, and it matters.
Right. there's a difference between a client asking you because they're interested and they want to understand, and a client sort of, you know, furrowing their brow at you. So yes,
that's totally right. And how much they mimic the questions as laid out by various short position managers as well. You can tell right. from that. Yeah,
that's right. And how do you think about that same sort of support on the company side? So obviously you have fairly concentrated positions. Your positions tend to be publicly known. How do you think about being an owner of, you know, Tesla or whatever company it may be that you have a reasonably large position in, particularly when things are not going straight up?
So broadly speaking, but I promise I won't make this completely bland. Broadly speaking, I think it's been terrific. And, you know, I think that there is this real hankering, perhaps I could get you to comment on this, but a real hankering for companies for long-term supportive shareholders. And if you like, and as I think two of us have touched on before, turning activism into being supportive activism for the current teams and current projects rather than an undermining of it. And that's been an absolute pleasure. And, you know, I don't think in all frankness that 15 years ago we would have expected to be really large shareholders of many of these companies, public and increasingly private, and to have the sort of dialogues and the constructive discussions we can have. And, you know, I think that constructive discussion part of it is important, isn't it? Because, you know, I think one of the great things about private company investing is you can discuss the hard problems. The trouble in public markets, you know, at a quarterly call with one of the big investment banks, if anybody utters a word about the difficulties faced, the next day you'll have a sell note and huge pressure in the market. So, you know, I think trying to get that position where we know we between us and the management of these companies that we will try and help. If I may, the risk of too long an answer, but one of, you know, I was talking about critical point with Vanguard, critical point with the companies was when we and one or two other people helped prevent the takeover of Illumina by Roche. And you know, what that had forced us and the management of the company to do was set out what the upside potential is. And I think this is a key part, isn't it, of the long-termism. It's only then that those compounding returns, those concerns at scale really come into view. And I think that matters a lot as an experience, as well as giving us confidence.
Yeah, I think that's it's a great example. And to your point on compounding, that's one of those mathematical things we all know and continually boggles the human mind, because it doesn't feel like the numbers should work that way, but they do. So
they do.
Right. And, but they actually do. Right. Yes.
Yes. And you know, we've been very, very influenced by what we've seen on that score. But that compounding means, as you well know, that whether you like it or not, and plenty of people don't like it, that a very few small number of stocks come to dominate your portfolio. And that's been one of the other interesting pathways. You know, we were trying to think about why that extent was, and that led us to conversations and meetings with Henrik Bessenbinder at Arinsa & Estate, and his point that actually equity market returns are just like venture capital returns, and they certainly are like the bell curve that people who think they can decide what risk, et cetera, is matter. So, you know, the reinforcement of that loyalty, but that loyalty comes with a need to cope with the 40 to 50% downturns that get obscured by all these long-term charts showing from bottom left to top right. But if you break them down from Amazon to Tesla, you know, as you know, there are vast numbers of these big drawdowns, but rather the same phenomenon in China at the moment.
So as you were mentioning the private companies and this ability to really talk about the problems, we often hear from private companies too that, to your point on the 40% drawdowns, it feels better if no one's marking that to market. You know, you could sort of fix the problem, or you can, you know, work your way through it without being on the front page of the paper or having having a cell note written on you. Do you think that's better? Is this a fundamental problem with the public markets these days, or is there a way around that?
I think it is a fundamental problem. Of course, you know, you do have the compensating downside of there suddenly being a 40% down on a new round, a rescue round, or when do your valuation groups just decide? So, but I do think it's that drip is profoundly undermining, isn't it? And it does tend to attract journalists more. You know, I think it's only with the really big private companies, the obvious ones that we could all name in America and China, where you get that similar amount of pressure. And I do wonder whether, you know, the media broadly defined doesn't have more of an importance in this than we think. And, you know, we sort of try and tread a quite fine line of being willing to be open about our holdings, how we think about them. But the last thing we want to do is be rent a quote. And of course, we don't trade very much. You know, our quarterly holdings releases don't provide much of excitement for most commentators.
Right. Well, you did a little bit in the FT a couple of months ago that I thought were very interesting points about the role of the fund management industry or even more broadly in financing or not financing tech companies and growth companies, early stage companies, particularly in the UK. Can you describe a little bit about that for people who haven't read it and why you think it's easier to get funded in the US or even you mentioned the Dutch or the Swedes, you know, that there are examples there. What's going on in the UK?
I think the UK is, if you like, the extreme example. And I really do think it is the extreme example. You know, I can't see anywhere else that it's quite the same on this score of capital markets becoming a combination of wealth preservation rather than either growth or the stock markets as being important per se. And what I mean by that is I think ultimately one of the directions that long-term investing has taken us is a belief that we're here to solve problems. And if you like, that solving problems is what, as a side path, enables you to make money for your clients. But, you know, you don't aim at the making money, you aim at the solving problems, which inevitably takes time. And I think that mentality, because of the dominance of finance in Britain and the dominance of wealth preservation, is very great. And if you look at it, and this was, you know, originally came just as an observation rather than a deliberate, if you like, analysis and criticism, we simply don't have many companies in the UK, in the UK major market index, that are anything other than 19th century in their origins and in their type of business. And I think you can boil that down. You know, I don't want to take up your listeners' times on this, but to many celebrated but malign examples. You know, what happened to Arm, for instance? You know, people inside the company, but also the board, also the expectation of shareholders was that you wouldn't finance them through a difficult period of time, that you would sell out to SoftBank and Mr. Song. And, you know, I think that having the examples is terribly important. You know, one of the things that I constantly ask people in Sweden is why it's possible to build new companies such as Northvolt and the like. And a lot of it is about emulation, but it's also about elements of society going back. And, you know, I was having this discussion with somebody associated with the British government, I think I'm allowed to say this recently, about, you know, Trump, because they responded, rather to my surprise, to these reactions. And, you know, it's talking about this emulation, but also talking about just how hard it is. And, you know, we exchanged emails and I gave him the name of a 400-page book about just simply the first 20 years of ASML in Holland, which is, after all, you know, now a global monopoly, and arguably the hardest tech of the world, and without which nothing that we've seen of all the social media companies and e-commerce companies could exist, because it's them who keep Moore's Law going. That just the endurance and the ability, you know, it's what we do in fund management is just a small example of what they have to put up with, isn't it? And there are many occasions when bankruptcy could happen. So it's just hard. And I'm not sure people in Britain are really up for 20 years hard slog, to be quite honest.
Yeah, maybe that's right. I recently read Phil Knight's book about Nike, which, you know, yes. Nike seems like it's, you know, what a great brand. How easy could it have been? It was a slog, and they almost went bankrupt a number of times. So, yes.
Absolutely. It's a great book about that, isn't it? And that combination of resilience, skill, and also, I think he would be perfectly happy to admit luck that you had
luck,
to have.
Luck. Yeah. That's right. Interesting. Well, and as you think about the building and support of these new companies, obviously one of the trends over the last number of years has been companies getting more and more support in that private stage, you know, the unicorns and being bigger companies before they come to the public market. And you've obviously played a role in that. Do you think that's a solution to the problem of having a little bit more endurance and having people locked in more? Is it something more structural, like a different way of, you know, dual class shares, different ways of structuring? Are there things that work that are sort of practical and easier to emulate than just having examples that we can look to or building endurance?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I was originally trained, or as one of my colleagues said, semi-trained as a historian. And one of the phrases that stuck in my mind was a British foreign secretary in the 19th century saying that to redress the balance of the old world, you needed to call a new world into existence. And I think that is fundamentally what's happening in markets, because our public capital markets are so much about paying out rather than building for the future. We've had to go and reinvent a new world. And that new world, I think, in deference to many of the great venture capital funds, mostly in America, mostly in the West Coast of America, are willing to do that task of providing supportive shareholders, much better shareholders by and large than the public markets, but also to take those longer views. And I think to understand the motivation of many of the people involved in this a lot. You know, formal part of that is, as you say, multiple voting rights, which, you know, we've long been used to because we experienced them in Scandinavia. And whilst we don't approve of no voting rights, I think multiple voting rights is helpful in this context. But isn't it also a greater tolerance of the unusualness, the uniqueness of what's going on? And, you know, if I may, a couple of people's points on that, which I think are important. So our long-term board member, now sadly retired at Scottish Mortgage, John Kay, the economist, Sir John Kay these days, has this wonderful passage, which I will misquote, about great companies being the inverse of the first few lines of Anna Karenina, in that all great companies are different, whereas all bad companies are the same, rather than all happy marriages being the same. And I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the prime examples at the moment, both we're directly involved as shareholders, large shareholders of Moderna, but also in, you know, their parent companies, you know, at Flagship, Noubar Afian's great comments about how you can't expect unreasonable results to come from reasonable people and reasonable companies. And you have to be willing to encourage, and we could both think of other examples within the landscape, you've got to be able to encourage that extraordinary level of ambition, eccentricity, skills, idiosyncrasy, that I think is easier to do in private markets. There aren't many people in public markets who can carry that off, are there?
Right. Or they now there's an option. So why do they have to? Right. I think that's one of the challenges. If the public markets are the only game in town, you know, you deal with it. But we know there's so much competition among the markets now. Interesting.
Yeah.
I'd love to ask you a little bit about and I almost don't even like the term, but ESG or sustainability. And you've made some comments about being careful of box ticking. You know, as I'm sure you know, our view is that in the short term, many of those things don't matter. And a lot of the ESG kind of stuff can actually be short term, but if you're going to hold a company for many, many years, then these things come into the fore, whether they are being a good corporate citizen, serving their communities well, treating their employees well, and so on. So as a long-term investor, how do you think about incorporating those sorts of factors into your decision-making and staying away from the box ticking problem?
Oh, it's to be frank, it's a day-to-day problem, and it's even more, and I think this is a good thing, an issue today and presumably tomorrow that it has been when I started in the industry. So I love your formulation of it. It is about the long term, and it is about trying to make good corporate citizenships with all those external issues that companies can make. But I do think that you can't and shouldn't and must indeed boil those down to a set of instructions brought up by whichever body which you adhere to or whoever standards you do. And I think that is fundamentally because of what we've been talking about at two levels, both the uniqueness that any corporate culture has if it's truly distinctive, and also because it is the outliers that have a real impact, even more than in measuring equity performance. You know, the numbers of companies that can truly help address the huge issues we have in the world. And I think climate is both incredibly serious, but also a great example of this. You know, frankly, most companies don't matter that much in this regard. Of course, you can encourage good practice, but what we should concentrate on, it seems to me, is owning, supporting, and encouraging those companies who can have a profound transformational effect. So if you like, it's much more about impact investing and concentrating our efforts on a fairly small number of people. And, you know, I don't want to talk about it at every stage in this, but, you know, I think that, you know, you have to consider Tesla as an epic example of both sides of this. That there aren't many corporate governance standards, ESG standards, who will sign off on what Tesla does for all the efforts that chair and the like make on that front. But, you know, one has to be fair to Mr. Musk. What they have achieved for advancing the cause of at least stopping some of the climate deterioration and moving not just themselves, but a whole industry on, is truly important. And, you know, so thereby, you know, I do think it's important that we concentrate where and with companies who can make a real difference in impact terms and in a deep transformation, if you like.
And as you said before, it's about problem solving. People get paid to solve problems if they do it well. So if we can solve a problem like climate change, hopefully somebody will get paid a lot to do it. And that's the upside.
Yeah, and we're talking precisely that example in the bonus structures that we're willing to support. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, exactly. Great. Well, let me switch gears a little bit to the Panmure House Prize, which of course you were instrumental in, we had a small part in helping organize. So, would you like to describe a little bit about for our listeners who don't know what Panmure House is, whose house it was and why is it so important?
Yes, but delighted to. So, Panmure House and now owned by Heriot Watt University. Was the last home of Adam Smith. And I think it's fair to say, you can absolutely feel his ghost there at the time, and his ghost of his discussions, in particular, his long suppers with David Hume. I was talking about this with an Ursoir colleague the other day when we met at the Edinburgh Book Festival, and he said, but the thing that's always puzzled me most is the amount of wine they got through in an evening. And whilst we agreed that the wine was less strong than it is now, it certainly seemed to have lubricated many of the discussions. So we think that, you know, Adam Smith, David Hume, the intellectual heritage of what Edinburgh once was, and I'm going to make no pretenses like that today, are actually inspiring examples that we ought to learn, and much more to do with the long term than many of the traditional interpretations of particularly Smith would end. But we also think, and again, I'm delighted if I can tempt you to express a view on this, that both the investment industry, as we've talked about a lot, but also much of academia, has not really been solving problems. And indeed, it's moved towards a highly formalized set of equations about the economy, which don't really explain the economy, least of all innovation. So we felt, and we responded to conversations from the people at Panmure, good people at Panmure House from this point of view, that we could try and think about how Panmure House could inspire people to pay attention to helping economics solve some of these innovation-linked problems and helping the fund management industry solve them. That even like they're two industries that have gone in the wrong direction, and that we hope this can make a contribution to changing it. And we've been encouraged with your help, and you shouldn't be modest about it, that many of the original entries for the first prize this year are pointing in that direction, but we think there's still more to be done.
Well, I think that this idea that both fund management and academia can come together to push long-term innovation is critical, because as you've said, it's so fundamental to solving the world's biggest problems. And academia has also become very, you know, the problem has been, how do I get a paper published, rather, which is sort of like the problem in fund management being, you know, what are my returns this quarter? And neither one of those are the things that we would remember an influential academic or a serious fund manager for. So we're really hopeful helps.
Interject at that point. I think one of the really interesting things about moving towards long-term is that we have found that the utility and role of at least some academics becomes greater and greater. And, you know, I, for instance, we've done a lot of work with people at the Santa Fe Institute, such as Brian Arthur and Jeffrey West, who think about economics in a completely different terminology and think about, you know, network scale effects, you know, how you gradually solve some of these problems, the difficulty of solving them. So I think it does actually tug you towards both academia and a different type of academia.
That's right. And I think, I mean, you mentioned the Bessenbinder work earlier, or even Hans Rosling, who was, you know, some of these works can be so influential, or Milton Friedman. I mean, let's, you know, we can come back to him too. So I think we're strong believers that the academic community can have a profound long-term impact on behavior. And it does usually take some time. So getting that to think about innovation is important. One of the things I also think has been interesting with these discussions, particularly beyond the people who are close, is the Adam Smith. Everybody knows the Wealth of Nations, but they may not know the moral sentiments. And in some ways, what we're talking about, whether you want to call it sustainability or long-term or whatever, is a little bit of the moral sentiment side. Is there a way that we can... That this isn't actually new at all? It's going back to Adam Smith and Edinburgh all those years ago, sitting in Panmure House drinking wine with David Hume, thinking about the sort of balance among those two.
I think that's right. I mean, my only sort of slight feeling about this is that, you know, I think our interpretations of Wealth of Nations has actually been colored by you being used for, you know, pretty ideological purposes. And, you know, I'm not even sure, you know, I occasionally go back and read chapters of it. I had to read it at university, so my first reading was probably a bit warped by that. But, you know, I don't think it's as transactional a book as is commonly portrayed of. But, you know, I think if you think about his whole life, his mentality, you know, what he was talking about with humor as well as theory of moral sentiments, yeah, there was something much, much broader. And it was, of course, I think it's worth remembering, the Wealth of Nations plural. And I think one of the very interesting aspects is how international that book was for the time and the very many different models from France to China that it was looking at.
That's right. And that's obviously also been part of your investment approach for a long time, is being very global. So the last thing I'll ask you on the investment side is, you mentioned China a few minutes ago, and, you know, things that are down a lot there. Can you give us a long-term perspective on China and how you think about the geopolitical challenges that we have there from an investor's point of view?
Well, the first thing to say is that our experience with companies, the companies that we've owned, has been very similar to that elsewhere. You know, the companies have been intensely helpful, intensely open in discussing all sorts of challenges and all sorts of opportunities alike. So you can guess that we're trying to think this through, but for the long term, and you know, we're trying to build links with Chinese academics to help us understand the history of it. But you know, I do think that there are sort of two competing paradigms here, if you like. The first is that, you know, in all frankness, this looks more like a reversion to mean than most investing is to us, China's position in the world economy. And, you know, I think if you think about what's going into it from an educational, scientific, infrastructure reason, we're pretty sure that will continue. I think the second one about, if you like, the broad political and social issues, so I just don't think we can, you know, it's back to the humility ones. I don't think we can be arrogant about it. I don't think we know whether you need to follow, you know, the classical European and American processes towards economic development and assume democracy at the end of it. And, you know, I think one should sort of view that as something that we need to look, listen and learn about rather than being too dogmatic about it. But, you know, put it all back together again. I don't think you would quarrel with the view that most of the dramatic challenges facing the world, the problems to be solved, are global. And, you know, we can't walk away from these countries, whatever, you know, one may on a personal level think about various aspects of them. It is impossible to address the climate issues unless we address them with China. You know, I always feel ashamed of saying it because it's so obvious, but I think it compels us to engagement, even if the engagement is difficult and challenging.
Yes, I think if there's one thing we've learned, and we should have always known, but is the world is connected. We've certainly learned that.
Yes, and it's a lot more obviously so than in the days of Wealth of Nations, isn't it?
That's right, exactly. No, exactly, where you had to get on a ship and hope you got to the other side of the world. That's right. Well, you have announced your retirement from Baillie Gifford coming up in April of next year. You've obviously been very involved in the long-term thinking with Panmure House. You have managed these funds and involved in the companies for so long. So as you look forward, what do you expect comes next, either for the fund management industry or even for you after the after April of next year?
My first comment would be that I very much hope that we're sufficiently embracing of the long term that I really, quite apart from the fact that I have so many very clever successors, far cleverer than I, that, you know, that we will continue thinking about that. So, you know, that's a great comfort. On the fund management one, I think we will see this bifurcation increasing between those who, well, let's label it, are the real activists trying to solve problems. Of course, many of them are associated with the private market, venture capital type investing, and those who cannot get away from the, you're really running it for the good of those inside the investment management industry, you're doing very conventional distribution risk, who I think will find it very difficult to evolve. So, you know, I sort of see the schism as increasing, and I can only hope that, guess which side I would like to win within that, one never knows. From my own perspective, I've already become chair of a Swedish investment company called Kinnevik. And one of the background objectives for that is, as we touched on, although it's not as bad as Europe, as bad as the UK, we do think much needs to be done in Europe to addressing some of these problems and having a dialogue, having a network that can talk about these issues and how to improve on that score. As you'll know, Scotland counts itself a part of Europe rather than a part of Britain in many ways. So, you know, I hope it fits in well from that point of view. But, you know, I'm looking forward to spending time on trying to address, if you like, some of the more root causes of all this than necessarily one does day to day in a fund management capacity.
Well, that sounds terrific. And it sounds like you're going to have a huge impact on that. And I know we're going to stay in close touch as you move on to the next challenge. So thank you so much for your time and your insight today, for your leadership in the fund management industry, for your leadership in the Panmure House Prize and really, really making that happen. And just thank you so much for being a part of pushing this long-term thinking. So thank you.
Thanks to you and your institution. And it's been a pleasure talking.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Going Long with FCLT Global. Be sure to hit subscribe to get new episodes every other Monday. To learn more, visit our website at fcltglobal.org.